Please be seated. The next case on the en banc court's calendar this afternoon is Hoover v. State, case number 63888. Or I should say it's probably Hover, isn't it? Over. Okay. There you go, Mr. Orem.
I am.
Okay, thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Christopher Orem. I represent Gregory Hover. I would ask for 10 minutes for rebuttal in this case. Mr. Hover's capital case was a very difficult case. As the court can see, the evidence against Mr. Hover, the facts against Mr. Hover, was very significant. And that's what leads right into my first argument, and that is that Mr. Hover desired to present evidence through brain imaging of possible mitigation. What I did in that situation, and I think maybe I didn't articulate it well when I started this argument, was that the state had Mr. Hover charged with two separate homicides and a third one where it was attempted homicide where a lady was taken into a closet and shot in the head. In the case of Prisma Contreras, she was abducted on video. She was raped, murdered, set on fire, and about 100 feet away from her vehicle was a condom. And my client's DNA was located on that condom, according to the state's expert, and Ms. Contreras was also located on the condom. What that tells me, and would tell anybody who has any experience dealing in capital cases, is that at the beginning of this case, you're in a fight for your client's life. And in this case, if you look at the mitigation that I put on, it was traditional 1940, 1920, 1870 mitigation of, I'm going to put on life facts. I'm going to call Mr. Hover's son. I'm going to call Mr. Hover's daughter. They're going to talk about the love they have for their client or for my client. And I'm going to put on the fact that he tried to kill himself. So I went a little further. And my expert said that we should get a brain imaging conducted. We applied to Nevada Imaging, which accepted Mr. Hover as a patient. We then contacted the Office of Appointed Counsel and asked for fees in the amount of $3,246 plus transportation costs of $75, which was approved. We contacted the Clark County Detention Center, Lieutenant Scott Zolman. He approved it.
Just ask one question? I've gotten one question I need cleared up. Did you ask for a PET scan or an MRI?
In the order, it says an MRI, but I believe it was
very
going to be
specific.
I believe it was going to be a PET scan, but it does say MRI on the order. It says right on the order, which I have in front of me, it says the MRI.
In the moving papers below, was a PET scan requested or an MRI?
It says MRI.
In the paper, in the moving papers as well as
it
the
does.
Order.
Yes.
In the hearing that was conducted, if there was a hearing in this case, is that what was put forth as well?
Second issue is, Your Honor, I understand the court denied or was not willing to sign an order to have brain imaging done, Mr. Hofer. And I'm quoting from page Bates stamped 1267. So brain imaging is what I requested. And Justice Perry-Gary, it also does say that the Office of Appointed Counsel had permitted an MRI. Okay, so when you're asking me that, I don't know exactly what test they would exactly perform, but I believed it was some type of brain imaging, which
right.
was requested.
Mr. Orem, I'm trying to make sure I have what's in the record on this. I have what was marked as Exhibit 6, which is ex parte motion for medical treatment, and the Bates numbers on the bottom are 4419 through 4426?
Yes.
And that's the motion, and it has the form of order attached. And then you referred a moment ago to a hearing transcript 1267 where the court references it as brain imaging.
Yes.
Those are the two places in the record that I can find that address this issue.
Correct.
Is there anywhere else in the record that I could look at that bears on this?
No.
Okay.
There's nothing else. It was very simple. We put forth this order.
You expected it to be granted, so
right.
because there was no opposition in any all the way up to the point of the judge signing it.
Yes, that's correct. And if you look at the April 15th transcript, which is base stamped at 12:48 on April 15th, 2013,
yes.
I bring up that there's this order, and my understanding is the court had contacted my office and said, we're not going to sign anything.
Well, and that's where I'm still looking at this. There's an indication that there was a concession to the district court the scan wasn't necessary to diagnose Hover. And, in fact, the defense sought the testing simply because Hover was facing the death sentence. And that was indicated at Record on Appeal 4421.
When you say that, Justice Perry-Gary, I don't understand your question.
Well, you say you had requested these scans, these magnetic imaging or PET scan, one of the two, but later on in the record, it appears that you conceded that there really wasn't a basis for this, and simply because this was a death case, you wanted the imaging.
No, I don't agree with that assessment.
That's all I'm trying to clear up.
It's a very short hearing, Your Honor, and in fact, it's contained on one page. There's other hearings taking place on April 15th, and I say, Your Honor, the second issue is, I understand that the court denied or was not willing to sign the order to have the brain imaging done of Mr. Hover. And then I say, Your Honor, I can say I did go to Mr. Christensen, and I have emails from him indicating that it would be acceptable for me to have the MRI. And so the only thing I can tell the court is that we wanted to have his brain scanned to see what the results would be. And in the order itself, I have it listed that my psychiatrist, or is the psychologist, had referred the matter to Nevada Brain Imaging and suggested it. And so what I had is my only expert saying, send this over for brain imaging. And so that's what I did. And so I jumped through all the hoops, Justice Perry-Gary, of making sure it would be acceptable. The state didn't object. And what else is interesting, and I think is important for the court to recognize, is I argued before this court up in Carson City on a capital case, State of Nevada versus Chapel, which this court has affirmed. And in that case, a similar issue came up about brain imaging. I had asked the same district court judge for brain imaging in a post-conviction case and for the funding. It was denied. I'll inform this court has affirmed Mr. Chapel, so disagreeing with me, rehearing is pending. But the fact of the matter is that occurred, Chapel's denial by the district court judge occurred on 10-19-2012, a year before. So I had an indication when I walked into this court, I heard from the judge's chambers that the judge was not going to sign it, that I knew I wasn't going to be able to get anything. And so I'm not quite sure. This isn't a matter where I consented to it at all. I just recognized the court wasn't going to grant it. And so what more could I do other than say I had funding for it? And the court saying, well, what will it show? And I think the court says to me, this is just a fishing expedition and nothing more.
Is there any suggestion in the, looking at your motion, which you signed as an officer of the court, I mean, you say Mr. Hover is facing a death sentence. As such, it is necessary that the undersigned, referring to yourself, have the defendant properly evaluated for any deficits that may arise from the result of an MRI. The undersigned's expert has submitted a referral to Nevada Imaging, and Nevada Imaging has accepted Mr. Hover. As the capital trial is approaching, it's imperative that this be completed. Do we have anything in the record from the testimony of Melvin Pohl or anyone else that his conduct was so aberrational as to against the norm of his life that this was warranted, that there might be some suspicion that there was neurological damage or deficits, head injuries? I mean, I know you talk about as a child he was knocked around.
Yes, and then I know the state will argue and counter what I'm about to say with this occurred afterwards, but Mr. Hover attempted one suicide where he jumped from a tier with blankets, sheets, and he actually hung from the second tier over at the Clark County Detention Center. Hung for some time because another inmate came out and testified.
But that was after the crimes in this case.
That is after, yes.
So, but leading up to this, is there any kind of scientific argument in this record other than this motion and what I just read to you that would have supported?
Just the head injuries as a child that
okay.
he had, his
okay.
head slammed into a wall. He'd been punched by his father. He had received a lot of abuse, but I don't have hospital records or medical records to show the court that there's going to be a problem with his brain. I don't.
There was testimony, and I don't know that this would show up on a PET scan or an MRI, that the methamphetamine would have some type of an impact on his brain. And is that something you were trying to establish would show up on a PET scan?
It wasn't, and I see where you've gotten that.
Dr. Pohl, I think, testified
That's right.
to that.
And he did, but Dr. Mel Pohl was not the individual who did the referral. It was. I only cited that in my brief because when I was actually examining Mel Pohl and he made those statements, and then I went back when I was writing this appeal, I also thought that was ammunition for why it should have been done. But I can't honestly say. In fact, I know it's wrong for me to say that because I knew what Mel Pohl was going to say. I wanted to see if that was accurate. It was just at the time I had my psychologist saying, "Get it done. There may be something here." And Mr. Hoover had lived a decent life. I mean, if you'd seen the pictures of Mr. Hoover's life, it's sort of remarkable to think, if you'd seen his wife and children, that this was a middle-class guy who'd done fairly well in life and went off the deep end. And but given those facts and given the fact that I had requested it, had the funding for it, no objection to it, I don't see why. I'm even arguing before this court about it for $3,300. And I like to quote the court something that I think is the best reasoning of anything connected to this issue. And I'm going to read what I've cited from Hoskins versus Florida, and it is cited throughout my brief. It's a 1997 case, and this is a quote from the Florida Supreme Court, and they're citing to Aki versus Oklahoma. As noted by the United States Supreme Court in Aki versus Oklahoma, when a defendant demonstrates to the trial judge that his mental condition is at issue, the defendant must have access to a mental health expert who will conduct an appropriate examination and assist in evaluating, preparing, and presenting the defendant's defense. This is especially true in death cases, where the consequence of error is so great. We have previously found that the failure of a mental health expert to adequately investigate a defendant's mental history and to order, if warranted, additional testing regarding the defendant's condition deprives the defendant of due process. This is because such failure may deny a defendant the opportunity through an appropriate psychiatric examination to rebut factors in aggravation and to develop factors in mitigation of the death penalty. We're citing to ACCI. And in Chapel, this court asked me a very good question. I don't remember which justice asked it of me, but what were you hoping to show? And at the time, I tried to argue to this court, well, I'm not an expert. I can't tell you what it's going to show. If I sit here and tell you that it's going to show that he had a lump right here in the front of the brain, I would think the court would look at me and think, you can't know that. Okay? So this is what I was hoping to do. In 1994, a man named Adrian Raine analyzed 41 convicted killers, did brain scans, noticed a significant reduction in development of prefrontal cortex, the executive function of the brain, which equals less control of limbic system that generates primal emotions such as anger and rage, addiction to risk, and reduction in self-control. My understanding is New Mexico now is starting to test a lot of their inmates as they're released because they actually believe they can predict future dangerousness and recidivism. And so given these factors, I would think that I was entitled to this brain imaging. And I also think the more the court would embrace the state's argument that there was overwhelming evidence of guilt, the more this court embraces that, the more the error is obvious.
One thing that you had mentioned, and again with what you had just read, the test should be given if warranted. And what I want to hear from you is what in this particular case would warrant that test being given?
The psychologist recommending it.
No. And I want to hear specifically what conditions existed at the time that would warrant this test.
The fact that he had been beaten in the head by his father on a couple of occasions.
And how far back does that go?
he was a middle-aged man, so we're talking 30 years, at least. When I say that, if you figured it out and went back and looked at the penalty phase and said, oh, that happened. Happened in his youth. The beatings to the head happened in his youth, Your Honor. And he this occurred when he was a middle-aged man.
And you had just indicated that this was a remarkable case in the sense that, you know, he lived a fairly normal, uneventful life.
Correct.
And
correct. And so, why, given the rationale of the Florida Supreme Court 2 decades ago, why should we deviate from that? Why in that case, the district court in a capital case refused the funding and the Florida Supreme Court remanded the matter? Why should we be different? Why? What sense does it make in Nevada that we are simply going to ignore this and let a district court sua sponte, just deny the application for the PET scan or for the MRI?
You could have paid for it if you were a retained lawyer.
And Drew Christensen gave me the funding. I had the funding. There was no problem. This was simply the judge saying, I'm not going to let you do it.
Well, if he had been enormously wealthy or had enormous money behind him so he could pay for this himself, he still would have needed the order of transport and so forth.
Correct.
Would the court have been able to turn that down were public funds not to be used? In terms of the exercise of the discretion here, I get your point that it was an impermissible exercise, but does he stand in a different position because of having the state pay for this?
I don't really think so, because in the end what the judge really did was just deny the transport order. The funding was there. There was the only thing that needed to be done was an order saying the court, it's approved, now they can transport it. And that's all that needed to be done. So
it's the only thing you needed approval on.
Correct. I had approval on everything. In fact, in the order itself, if you look at the order, I laid it all out for the district court judge. I even gave the judge the name of the officer, the lieutenant who had approved it. We actually put it in there, Lieutenant Scott Zollman. And I put a phone number for him, and I also put what looks like an email address for him, so if the court had any difficulty whatsoever. So to me, this was a matter of we had the funding. We had he'd been accepted as a patient, and he'd been referred as a patient. So obviously, I didn't put on a psychologist. I put on Mel Pohl. Mel Pohl was just to talk about what the effects of drugs are. I didn't call the psychologist because the psychologist wasn't providing me anything that's helpful. And so the psychologist, in an effort, said, do the brain image. So I got approval. It's denied. I have funding. It's denied. I don't understand that. And the reason I also say it's remarkable is because this court has to recognize the level of difficulty of what I was defending against. And so am I really just that handcuffed where all I can do is put on, you know, a defense of his son doesn't want him to die. Daughter doesn't want him to die. And that just seems so backward. And it seems so behind the times. And to think that I can quote from a case 20 years ago that makes perfect sense is of serious concern to me. If I realize I only have 2 minutes left, if I could address a couple of other issues in Mr. Hover's case. I know I have raised a lot of issues, but a couple caused me concern, and one of them was the DNA testing. As I stated, the DNA testing appears to me to be checkmate in this case. The condom was an extraordinarily difficult fact. I then wished to present some questions to the DNA analyst about problems in the DNA lab. I laid them out for the district court judge, and I was told you will not be cross-examining her about any of those matters. Once that happened, I couldn't attack her on the science. I didn't have the ability. I didn't have any real ammunition, and I don't think I questioned her really at all. I think my only plan of attack was to say that with your margin of error, you say that Mr. Hover's DNA is there, it's 1 in 650 billion. And so really what I wanted to do is say, okay, fine, so it must be him, unless, of course, your system, your laboratory has analyzed, let's say, 1,000 people, and you've made 4 errors. Now that is the problem. There's your margin of error. If something's going to go wrong, it's the human error in that laboratory. And I wasn't permitted to do that. And I contrasted that in my brief with what Judge Glass let me do in a capital case of Brian Wayne Crawley, which I tried against Mr. DiGiacomo, so he's intimately familiar with this. And I asked the DNA analyst at the beginning, Was your laboratory closed down in 2000 for problems with the lab? She admitted it, and then she began, unbeknownst to me, I asked her, how many errors have you made in this case? And she admitted, started to admit up to 8 errors in this case. And then she said, well, as a result of the errors in this case, we've had to check 10 to 15% of all our cases in the laboratory. That's important cross-examination. And what's happening under Lobato is I'm not being permitted to make that kind of cross-examination. I wasn't able to go to specific instances of conduct. And that, to me, really hampered the defense in this particular case. Additionally, lastly, before I'm done, I would like to address the fact that I wish to show the jury that Mr. Freeman was a bad person who was probably much more culpable for the murder of Prisma Contreras. If I could just finish this.
Go ahead.
That he was much more culpable for the murder of Prisma Contreras, and I would like to show what the state was going to present in his penalty phase in terms of his knife play. He was often threatening people with a knife. With knives, Prisma Contreras was attacked brutally with a knife. So I wish to show this in terms of proportionality, and I was denied that request. I was also denied an opportunity to even put his attorney on the witness stand. She was not objecting. The state was objecting. Those are the issues I've asked.
What about the juror challenges? That's the ones that I'm interested in right now. You've got
juror
three
challenges.
Different jury challenges.
The juror challenges, there were four of real concern to me, Your Honor, and they were where I think I showed that I should have had challenges for cause because it prevented or substantially impaired the performance of the duty of the juror. And as I look at those, every one of those jurors that I cited on page 45 of my opening brief, every one of them should have been, my challenge for cause should have been granted. For example, juror number 89 said, if two murders were proven, I think the death penalty would be called for. How is that person considering all four forms of punishment? If we look at juror 148, she said, so I asked, so absent the comment about a getaway driver, as you walked in the room yesterday and thought about first-degree murder, there was no way you could convince or conceive a first-degree murder scenario that you thought of first-degree murder where you thought, yeah, term for years. The prospective juror said, not in my mind, no, a challenge for cause. Juror 225 said his cousin had been raped and murdered. She also appeared to affirm that she had been sexually assaulted. She stated that first-degree murder should always result in the death penalty in her questionnaire. The juror also affirmed in her questionnaire that first-degree murder should never be returned to society. No parole for first-degree murders because it costs taxpayers too much money. Juror number 240, so fair to say that on your personal feelings, if you find first-degree murder, you think you're going to lean towards either life without parole or death? The juror said, that's exactly what I said. I thanked her for her honesty and challenge for cause. Those all should have been granted. I'm having to waste challenges for cause, preemptory challenges, getting rid of...
For clarification, did you expend preempts on each one of those? I didn't think so.
As I stand before you, I can't answer that question. Okay. When I have my break,
some
I'll
maybe,
it.
But not all.
I'll look back at that.
What about Batson?
The Batson issue, even though I raised the Batson issue, and the state claimed, as they usually do, that it has to do with the female juror's knowledge of the criminal justice system, and that a lot of people have been wrongfully convicted, and I challenged on that juror as well. With that, I'll submit it for rebuttal.
Okay.
May it please the court, my name is Mark DiGiacomo, I represent the state of Nevada. I'd like to start with what Mr. Oram spent the majority of his time on, which is the brain scan, and ask the court whether or not you're just going to grant a blank check to criminal defendants, or does the judge have a responsibility to do some sort of gatekeeper function. Mr. Oram suggests to you that the Office of Appointed Counsel does gatekeeping functions. They don't. They will pay if a court orders it. So he filed a motion, and his motion essentially says, I want it, so can I have it, please? And the court didn't deny the motion. She held a hearing on the motion. And Mr. Oram takes the position that we didn't object. We never get in the middle. The state never gets in the middle of whether or not a particular defendant gets a particular service from the OAC or from the court in a witness motion or something to that effect. So our silence doesn't mean to suggest that we thought you should have granted this. She has the hearing, and as I think Justice Perigary brings up, it's a record on appeal. It's volume 6. It's 1267. She actually says to Mr. Oram, the court does, there has to be some belief that there is some objective or subjective finding that would require an MRI, some indication of an organic brain injury, some indication of something. Not we're just going to go do an MRI on someone's brain. And Mr. Oram's response was, no, that's the only reason. He doesn't discuss Dr. Pohl and the discussion about drugs with her. He doesn't say to her, look, Judge, I know that there is incidents of my child or my client's childhood that indicate that he had a traumatic brain injury, and thus my expert says this, my expert says that. Or my expert has done some testing, and it is unclear to my expert whether or not there is or is not, which I believe is the Florida case, a traumatic brain injury, so I need to do a testing. It's solely my guy's facing death. He's got a substantial likelihood of being convicted based upon this evidence, so I get to spend the money. And that's the court was saying, no, you have to tell me something, anything, that would justify an MRI, brain scan, PET scan, something. And ultimately, Mr. Oram chose not to disclose the information that came out during the penalty hearing. Now, why that is, I don't know, and that's the subject of a different proceeding, not an appeal. But certainly the district court was fully justified in denying this request for an imaging to expend public funds when those funds are limited in nature, and all the case law says that. There has to be some objective or subjective reason to do the testing, and Mr. Oram refused to provide that information pre-trial.
So when you defend him on ineffective assistance of counsel, what are you going to say?
Well, there's multiple ways that I'm going to defend Mr. Oram. I think that Mr. Oram created this situation, to be honest with you, in order to get a ruling that says the district court does not have that basis. He is going to tell you, and I think he would tell you now, the only thing he had that was indicative of potential result from an MRI is that some family member said 30 years before that he had been punched in the head or pushed into a wall, that he had no other objective criteria, that his own expert said, hey, I've done all the testing, and ultimately there's no evidence of a traumatic brain injury, but you can go get an MRI, I'll write you the referral for it. And Mr. Oram probably did not want to tell the court that because he knew it was going to get denied, and so he made this effort to get it. I think ultimately it would make no difference because Mr. Hover did jump from a tier after the crime occurred. He hung from a rope, and then the rope broke, and he smacked the back of his head on the cement a floor below, and he survived his injuries, but he had pretty significant injuries from that event. I imagine that any MRI that is going to show anything related to traumatic brain injury is going to be the result of an incident that occurred post-crime. Mr. Oram says, my expert said there may be something here. He never represented that. He said that just now to you. That's not what the motion says. It's just, I have a referral, and therefore he will be allowed to have his brain scanned. There's not a single fact that was before the district court in request for a brain scan from public funds. The case law does not suggest in the least bit, and it's all cited in both of our briefs, we don't disagree with what the case law is, that they have to provide some objective criteria in order to believe that there's going to be a result that it would be worth to expend the public funds.
Don't you think in mitigation that there's a relaxed standard as opposed to the guilt or innocence phase in a death penalty case? I mean, isn't death different?
I would think the guys who serve in life without wouldn't necessarily think that ultimately death is different, but I've heard that statement, and I would agree with that, that in this on this fact pattern that we have in our case, you'd expect the court to be somewhat liberal in providing a PET scan or a brain scan or an MRI, but you would still require there to be some objective fact in order to just spend money. If Mr. Oram came in and said he wanted money for anything, he'd have to give some justification. Otherwise, there is no gatekeeper function. Otherwise, it's just a blank tick. He asked for it, we're going to pay for it, and that's not what the case law says is the standard. So ultimately, the court's got to require there to be some presentation. And Mr. Oram could have, in fact, provided some and chose not to do so for any number of reasons. There's also the possibility that he wanted to make sure that we, the state, weren't aware of any of his mitigation prior to him getting the MRI. Had we known that Gentry was going to testify the way Gentry testified, perhaps we would have interviewed him or looked into other witnesses. He could have submitted the affidavit under seal under the rules, and that would have been an appropriate thing for him to do. But ultimately, Mr. Oram made the decision not to tell the court anything when queried. And on appeal, he has to live with that decision.
So you would disagree then with him when he says that a defendant who was super wealthy and could pay for this, would the court have the same gatekeeper function?
I would say no. I would think if a defendant could pay for it, with the exception of the jail
transport.
Having the transport issue, you wouldn't even have an issue with the court. You would just have a transport order. You wouldn't have this order is for both approval of the scan as well as for transport. And she denied based on approval. The transport was not an issue, I don't believe, in front of the court. He would have to ask the court for transport. But in my practice, the courts don't ever have a problem with transport as long as the jail agrees to it. So this issue is solely an issue about public funds. And the gatekeeper
adequacy
function,
of the showing to justify the expenditure. So you see it as just that.
It's just that issue. I don't believe that it's an issue of transport or where he's going or the date and time for security purposes. This issue is solely you have to provide some objective standard for a court to rely upon to make a decision to use public funds, or you're just giving a blank check, which who gets to control that? If Mr. Oram uses up all the money on his client, well, then the next defense attorney, when he goes to do it, and there's no money left. I mean, there has to be somebody who controls that function, and the only person is the district court judge.
Wouldn't that also require the purposes of admissibility? There's got to be a basis to introduce that evidence. What's the difference?
Well, the difference would be is if you have the evidence and it turns out the brain scan shows there's absolutely no damage there, for example. Mr. Oram isn't going to tell anybody the results of that because as a prosecutor, I'm not going to find that out.
Right.
If there is a result from it that somehow is mitigating in the defendant's favor, well, then so long as he can establish the admissibility by way of calling an expert and establishing he's an expert and capable of using the machine and the results are relevant, it would be admissible. But the question of whether or not we expend funds is a question of whether or not there's a likelihood to find relevant, admissible evidence. And you have to have some objective standard to do that. People, even very wealthy defendants, would not be expending money unless they thought that there was a belief that somehow this was going to help them. They're just not going to burn money good after bad. It's that the county has the deep pockets and someone has to control the funds that are being utilized.
But on his side of it, he says he wasn't profligate in what he was spending. He was, you know, had one expert on psychology, and then I guess Dr. Pohl. So this wasn't a case where there had been a whole series of requests.
No, I would agree with that. All he had to say was,
the science supports that this was such aberrant behavior that there may be some organic brain injury. Would that have been enough?
No, I would think that he would have to say, look, it's not that my expert gave me a referral. It's my expert has done some testing. I mean, we didn't get into the science of all this, but, you know, sort of like Zhao Ye Bai's case, right? He had all these experts, did an MRI or did an MMPI, did a cognitive functioning test. I mean, they're psychologists and psychiatrists that I'm sure the defense had, that I'm sure did testing, and we didn't hear from them in penalty, so my guess is that they weren't able to draw a conclusion that there was a cognitive functioning problem in his brain and said, hey, you know, maybe if you had an MRI that shows this, that might be helpful to us. But he has to assert that to the court, and the court has to be the gatekeeper. Otherwise,
is it correct? There's nothing more in this record on this than that Exhibit 6 and
Exhibit 6 and then the record on appeal.
Exchange on 1267.
1267. There is nothing else in the record. And certainly anything else in the record that he suggested to you about the sons being hit or Dr. Pohl, all of that is in the mitigation phase of the trial. This is
well, never mind that. It could have been brought back even on a motion.
That's told the court. Correct.
You could move to reconsider as well if you had new evidence. So.
Correct. You could at some point. He could have asked again based upon that limited information to do it again, and I don't know if the court would have reconsidered it, but certainly that was never done. At the time the court made the decision, she had zero knowledge of any basis to believe that the results of the MRI were going to be favorable to the defendant.
I think it's a good idea that the state does not take a position on the request, though. I think that you really covered yourself on that one.
Yeah.
And it's strictly between him and Judge Ellsworth or whoever.
That's certainly between him, Judge Ellsworth, and the Office of Appointed Counsel as to what funds get expended. It's not our issue. Just briefly on the other issues that Mr. Oram touched upon, there was the impeachment of the DNA analyst. I know that when I read the brief and he said biased of the analyst, and then I read our brief and we really addressed sort of, you know, why it is that this wasn't relevant. I can't figure out why it's even biased, to be honest with you. Kelly Gauthier was not the analyst in Crawley. Had Julie Marshner, who was the analyst in Crawley, taken the stand in Mr. Hover's trial, she certainly could have been cross-examined in another capital case. Isn't it true that you made 10 or 15 mistakes in the report in that particular case?
Well, doesn't it become relevant in the process that they use in evaluating the DNA and testing the DNA? It seems to me even if you've got a different person who's doing the testing now, if they're using the same procedure and the same protocol, that seems perfectly relevant to me for cross-examination.
Well, they're not. First, the judge actually, there's a whole discussion about that the policies and procedures that are in effect at the time this testing occurred is not the same as the problems that happened with Julie Marshner and the time period that they went back and checked 10 to 15% of Julie Marshner's cases. There is the firing of Mr. Oram calls Tracy Paulette, but her name is Christina Paulette. That was related to her own mistakes, errors, and whatever she personally did as it related to this case. There hasn't been any establishment, as far as I'm aware, and Mr. Oram had no evidence that he has submitted to you or is in this record that there is some procedural errors that are occurring at the time that Mr. Hover's DNA was being analyzed. This was what he basically wanted to say is Christina Paulette was a bad analyst, so that must mean that you're a bad analyst.
So it didn't go to the protocol itself.
Correct. None of the things that Mr. Oram wanted to ask questions about related to is there an error in protocol in any sense of the word. And so the questions to be asked of this witness didn't go to her bias and it certainly wasn't relevant as it related to her testimony. Had Kelly Gauthier made a mistake in another case, absolutely they'd be allowed to ask those questions, but certainly not in this particular case. There were a couple of other issues that Mr. Oram wanted to address. I don't think it takes much time to talk about Mr. Freeman. This court has repeatedly said over and over again that the admissibility of evidence at a penalty phase is solely related to the defendant's character, prior record, or the circumstances of the offense. The court did allow in Flanagan, and this was Mr. Seaton years ago, admitting the JOC of a defendant. I actually was going to take the position that Mr. Freeman's guilty plea agreement and judgment of conviction shouldn't be admissible in Mr. Hover's trial, but based on Flanagan, I allowed that to be admitted and did not fight it. But ultimately, is it really relevant what it is that a co-defendant's sentence received if we're talking about the character or the circumstances of the offense or the prior record? Ultimately, you know, Flanagan's the only published case, and, you know, why it was admitted that case is probably why it was admitted. It was the less culpable individual got a sentence less than death, and Mr. Seaton was using it to argue for death. But I actually think it's a somewhat dangerous precedent to go down, because what Mr. Oram wanted to do was put in Mr. Freeman's acts of violence to argue propensity for what acts of violence were committed against Prisma Contreras, and well, not so much the husband and wife that were shot, but certainly is related to Prisma Contreras. And a penalty hearing is never about anybody else. It's about the circumstances of the offense, the effects on the victim, and the defendant's character.
But to be clear, it was admitted that Freeman pleaded out and that he was no longer subject to the death penalty as a result of that plea. So
that's correct.
Unpublished, but Rodriguez recently, even that was not allowed.
Correct.
By the district court, and then it split this court. So your point is that it should not have gone further into the details of Mr. Freeman's life and circumstances.
Yeah, I don't think any of the cases, either Flanagan or Rodriguez, would suggest that you could ever get into what other bad acts has a co-defendant ever committed, and I don't believe that those should be admissible at all.
So your point is this goes as far as Flanagan, maybe further, but certainly there's no need to go further than that.
Correct.
Yeah.
And to the extent that they wanted to call the co-defendant's lawyer to put in this GPA, the court must recognize that I represent the state of Nevada not just against Mr. Hover, but I represent him against Mr. Freeman, and it was deeply concerning to me that Mr. Freeman's lawyer, without authorization from Mr. Freeman, was going to get on the stand and testify essentially on the behest of the co-defendant that should be arguing that he was more culpable, and it was completely irrelevant that she was just going to read the GPA. The GPA could be admitted any number of ways, and the court agreed that it was more prejudicial than probative on a number of issues and allowed that GPA to come in through just admission and stipulation.
What about the argument that removing the sting of the prior conviction by eliciting the facts on sexual molestation of one of the witnesses was improper? Could you comment on that?
Yes. Mr. Orem suggests in his brief that we were improperly impeaching our witness. We weren't. We properly impeached the witness. What we did was rehabilitate the witness as it related to the weight and credibility of that piece of evidence as it goes to her credibility. This wasn't, we were seeking to admit this evidence to reduce her credibility. We were, in fact, seeking to reduce the impact of her judgment of conviction. And certainly rehabilitation is always proper so long as it's relevant. And therefore, we didn't violate 50.095. We were actually rehabilitating the witness, and the court found that it was probative and relevant, and that seemed to be appropriate. And to the extent that anyone would disagree with it, it would seem like that was clearly harmless error in the sense that the probative value of what it is that she said, while it was inculpatory, Mr. Orem's right, the forensics in this case between the fingerprints at the Romero residence and the DNA at the Prisma Contreras scene and the cell site records in between those two and the identification of Mr. Romero, it was pretty compelling without ever calling a witness in the case that Mr. Hover was guilty of the crimes to which he was charged. Mr. Orem raises the challenges for cause. He forgets to mention in his brief that he actually waived his eighth preempt because he didn't feel the need to utilize all his preemptive challenges. He indicated that there were four jurors that said things that he felt would disqualify them. Each and every one of them afterwards, after either the court or the state traversed, qualified their statements and indicated not only that they would follow the law. And the difficulty that occurs in jury selection when there is a synopsis of the case and then there is a voir dire is you're not getting to the heart of what Leonard in those cases talk about, which is, you know, is the person substantially impaired, their beliefs impaired, such that they cannot sit on the jury, as opposed to, should I let a guy who committed these facts get a term of years, I think was one of the arguments for releasing one of the jurors. And ultimately, I mean, it's a question for the court, but it's the way I read the case law is you're not talking about the facts of the case. The facts are irrelevant. The only question is in a murder case, will you consider all four forms of punishment? It's not, you know, Mr. Hover is entitled to 12 people who think he committed all the acts that he committed in this case are entitled to a term of years. He's entitled to 12 people that in your average everyday murder case would be willing to consider all four forms of punishment. And he certainly had that. And I would note that all four of these individuals never sat on the jury, and thus there isn't really a basis to complain, since there was no juror that had a bias against the defendant that sat on the sitting jury. The only other issue that was addressed, and I don't know if it was raised by the justices or Mr. Oram, was the Batson challenge in this particular case. The record actually starts at 1770 and it goes very lengthy through 75. And essentially it's the exact same issue that Mr. Oram and I had in front of you when we argued Mr. McCarty, although this time Mr. Oram put it in the transcript itself. He's not suggesting that our preempt in that case was based racially motivated. He's suggesting that there is a racial disparate impact from a certain class or character of an individual that causes a problem. The court did not find that the defense even established the prima facie case, but then afterwards, this particular juror, as opposed to everybody else that was in that courtroom, said that she knew a number of people that are currently in prison that are actually innocent. As a prosecutor, it does not matter what race you are. If a juror says that, they are going to get preempted. And certainly, and I think it's Mr. Oram who says it in at Record on Appeal 1772, quote, but I don't mean to actually say when I use a Batson challenge that I think a prosecutor's racist, because I don't. And then he goes through a whole litany of essentially what his argument is on impact. So essentially, certainly he never met the requirements of Batson, and the district court who went through the analysis did so appropriately, and that wouldn't be a basis for reversal of the conviction. If the court has no other questions, I believe I covered everything that Mr. Oram discussed.
I did have one. It relates to the preemptory challenges on jurors. I hadn't really appreciated it until I read the material for this case and actually had forgotten the extent of deference extended by this court to the trial court in making determinations on the state of mind of the juror. In Walker, we say the trial court's determination of the juror's state of mind is binding. I'm wondering if that it's somewhat of an academic question, but maybe has other implications, whether we extend too much deference in that statement.
I would say you don't. I've tried a number of cases. Every time we get up here on appeal and I stand up in front of the seven of you, or sometimes it's the three justice panel, it's very hard to communicate to you what, from a cold record, mm-hmm. actually happened in that courtroom. Mm-hmm. So the judges are sitting up there. They see the demeanors of the jurors. We try, as trial lawyers, our best to get as good a description as there is within the record. But no matter how many words you speak, if you're sitting up there as a district court judge in jury selection, you by far have a better opportunity to view the demeanor, the answers, and the context of those answers. It's a little like a text message when you read a cold record, is you do not get the inference or the tone that a juror uses, the terms that they use. It's just the cold words, and us lawyers then utilizing those words for our benefit or not. I would think that a district court judge is supremely in a position elevated above anybody else to make a determination as to what that juror is thinking and the impressions from that juror, and I would not back away from Walker.
Okay, thank you.
Thank
Any
you
Any other questions
much.
For counsel? All right, Mr. Oram.
I'm concerned that essentially it sounds like the state's argument is that the issue with regard to brain imaging is something that I manufactured because I knew the judge was going to deny it. This last week, Judge Smith ordered brain imaging from the same place of a capital defendant that I'm about to go to trial on. So you have a split with your district courts here of who's going to permit it and who's not going to permit it. I think, Justice Pickering, you said it right. I thought it was going to be signed. I didn't think for the life of me I was going to be getting a call from chambers saying, we're not signing this. And so when I go over there, I thought, wow, when I listen to the argument of Mr. Giacomo, I think that is really clever of me. I go through, jump through all these hoops, get my one psychologist to recommend it. Nevada Imaging accepts him. We get Drew Christensen to approve the funding. The jail approves the transportation, and the order that I have is a motion for medical treatment and transportation.
But don't you think the better practice would have been to make a better record? It sounds like, you know, I made it sound like you were ineffective, and luckily Mr. Giacomo is going to make sure that you're not ineffective. But this case is going to live on forever because of this issue.
Correct.
And there's no doubt in my mind, because when I was a defense attorney, Frederick Boulware did a lot of brain imaging for my clients, and I presented very little. In fact, why didn't you go ex parte to Judge Ellsworth and get it? You didn't go in front of a motion. Why didn't you just go ex parte?
I did. It's ex parte order.
She just denied it.
She called my office. She didn't call my office. Her, actually, I got a call from the Office of Appointed Counsel asking me why I was doing this. I reminded the Office of Appointed Counsel that it was approved. I had the emails. And then I learned then, I was actually out of the country when I learned this, that I wasn't going to get this brain imaging. I then went in on April 15th, a week before trial, and the judges, I actually brought it up. You see, I'm like, judges, another they went through all these other motions, and I wanted to make sure it was on the record. So I knew before when I walked in there I wasn't getting it. And so this is a matter of argument. I did it ex parte. They weren't objecting. Nobody was objecting. I'd done everything. And I knew then, quite frankly, what's offensive to me is I felt like we were being mocked for even doing it. So if you see some of the transcripts, there's the one point that it doesn't really come clear. I looked at it again. The court says to me, the presence of a brain or something wrong with a brain, I mean, is that? And then goes on. And I thought, okay, fine. You know, if you don't want to do it, fine. Don't do it. But what am I supposed to do? Do a backflip and complain to the court? It's a week before trial. I'm being told the court's office is contacting me, my office, and saying, we're not doing this. I'm being contacted out of the country and learning this. Then I come in and I put it on the record. What was I supposed to do at that point?
Well, let me ask you this. Your opposing counsel indicated that you brought out all of this information during the mitigation phase of it, so you had the information available. Wouldn't it be easier to put that in your ex parte application for this brain scan and at least give the judge something?
No, because that's, like I told you before, Justice Perry-Gary, the fact that Mel Pohl said that on the witness stand, I didn't know he would say that about the brain slides.
He was talking about the methamphetamine,
right.
But you're talking about organic injuries that occurred 30 years before that you're using as mitigation, and yet you didn't use that in the affidavit.
Well, because in the affidavit, I was just sending over the order, and what I thought is if I have a mental health professional analyzing Mr. Hoover and then referring him to brain for the brain imaging, I thought that was sufficient. Why can I tell you why we should have brain imaging better than my psychologist? And I laid that out, that the psychologist referred him. He doesn't get into Nevada imaging unless our psychologist refers him.
Well, once you lost the motion, why didn't you have an evidentiary hearing? Why don't you say, I'd like to have an evidentiary hearing so that when it goes before the Supreme Court, that there'd be a record. There's no record here to speak of.
So, well, I think there is a record. I had done that type of thing in the Chapel case and been denied it. I had been denied the request, and I thought, well, I'm coming up here to argue, and this court has affirmed that. And so I'm not quite sure what could I have done at an evidentiary hearing. What could I do? There's nobody who can say what's going to be in that brain imaging. Nobody. I don't understand how a psychologist can come up here and say it's going to be a wart right here in the front of. How can they tell that? How? None of us can tell this. And we had the referral. Why can't we just get it done? We have district courts granting them all day long. Justice Cherry, you said you had it done all the time.
Constantly with Dr. Boulware, Frederick Boulware. He became very close friends with him. He did so many of my clients.
So what I should have done and told the district court, because that's what the state said on appeal, and if you look back at the Hoskins case, the Hoskins lawyer says nothing else other than, you know, I'd like to know a little bit more. Maybe this will help with impulse control. We don't know. There's nobody on this court who knows what it's going to show. Nobody's going to know. And so for me to start saying, let's have an evidentiary hearing because this is what it's going to show, how will we know this, Justice?
Well, at least then we could have said you were denied an evidentiary hearing. I mean, what are we supposed to say?
Well, that's what I argued before this court up north. And I argued it vehemently to this court that I was denied an evidentiary hearing, I was denied the funding, and this court disagreed with me. And that was for post-conviction. This man was What I'm trying to point out to this court is that this was a very serious case. I can't talk against my client, but when you look at those facts, you know I'm in a fight for this man's life. It's very clear. And so what am I left with? I'm left $3,300. I also took a little bit of offense to, I was fiscally responsible in this case. That we weren't going out getting five different experts. I had one psychologist, and that's what the psychologist told me to do.
Who was the psychologist, by the way?
Dr. Deborah Maiora. She's out of California.
Your motion, your ex parte motion, makes reference to an affidavit of counsel, but I don't see an affidavit of counsel. Were you just referring to the fact that as an officer of the court you signed the motion?
Yes, you're correct.
Okay, I was just wondering if I was...
No, you're not missing anything, no. That's simply what I had, and it seems like I'm getting hit with the reverse all the time, and that is, make a better record of what? What, as I stand here today, if you ask me the same question, what is it going to show, and what proof do I have? I have that he got hit 30 years before, he got punched, it's going to show what? It's going to show what? I don't know what it's going to show, and that's the problem. And am I desperate? Yes. And the more you push me into that, the more this court says how bad this case was, the more I would ask you to realize that I went with the one scientific thought that my psychologist gave me, that I thought this could help Mr. Hover, and I was denied that right. I see that my time is done. If there are no further questions, I'll submit it.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Orr. Mr. Giannacco, appreciate your arguments today and the briefing in the case. The case was